This podcast is dedicated to the memory of Rich Browning. Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, do we have a mortgage price war on our hands as Nationwide slashes rates again? The cheapest deal on the market is now 4.29%. Where next? Gold hits a record high, Bitcoin is raging again, but oil, well, that hits a five-month low. Simon explains all. We cover the case of the missing 600 grand ISA, and Crane is back on the case. This time she takes aim at Tesco. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, Nationwide has reduced its mortgage rates once again, bringing the cheapest deal on the market down to 4.29%. The move has sent ripples across the mortgage market after it announced its 11th consecutive round of rate cuts in just 4 months. So it means the best rates available now are almost 1% lower than the Bank of England base rate. So are the bad times well and truly over? Helen, Simon, welcome. Helen, Nationwide, 11? Times?
Yeah, they've been quite busy. So I don't think this means that the bad times are completely over, but things are certainly looking a lot better for people needing a mortgage than they were at the start of this year. So the cuts by Nationwide, the biggest cut is 0.31%. So it's reasonably chunky. And as you said, the best rate on offer from them now, which is actually a market leading rate, is 4.29%. That's for a 5-year fix with a £999 fee. That's with a 40% deposit. If you want to fix for 2 years, the cheapest rate is 4.65%. So it's looking a lot better than it was previously. And as you said, yeah, 11 cuts. That's basically because the base rate stopped going up in September. So the 11 cuts have all happened in the last 4 months. And that's because banks have seen the sort of brighter forecasts for where interest rates might be going, seeing the base rates stop going up. And they're thinking that, you know, the cost to them of providing mortgage is going down, so they can pass that on to their customers.
Right. So that is that it, Simon? Is this a forecast of what's going to happen to the base rate, Simon, do you reckon?
So what you've got is the scenario where, as you just alluded to, mortgage rates tend to look forwards. And never has this been more obvious than in the past 14 months of what can only be described as mortgage mania. The mortgage market has been totally nuts ever since the, well, which one shall I do this time? The ill-fated Liz Truss mini budget, which torpedoed the money markets for a short while before Jeremy Hunt stepped in and Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng stepped out. And we saw a massive spike in mortgage rates last autumn time as effectively interest rate expectations ran way, way, way ahead of what the Bank of England was actually doing. And all of a sudden there was this concern that all of these unfunded tax cuts that we were going to pay for by borrowing more money, but people didn't want to just lend us that money at the rates that we'd previously been borrowing the money. And so they started demanding higher rates in order to be lenders of that money to fund Britain. And, you know, all that kind of stuff led people to believe the Bank of England was going to have to whack interest rates up. 6.5%, I think we were going to be getting to. That was the belief in the money markets. We didn't obviously get to 6.5%. Mortgage rates did, though, and they raced off into the distance. Then when some calm was brought about after, as I said, Rishi Sunak took over, Jeremy Hunt had stepped in, they sought to calm the markets, and we saw interest rates come down quite a bit in terms of mortgage rates from the tail end of last year, around about this time. And actually, this is a good time of year to be looking for a mortgage because mortgage lenders are trying to hit their not only their end of month targets and their end of quarter targets, but their end of year targets. So it's quite competitive at this time of year because they're trying to get business in through the door. So we saw it this time of year, they started to drop. And then all of the beginning of last year, January through to Easter time, mortgage rates were drifting down. And they came down quite substantially at the same time as the base rate was going in the opposite direction. And what was going on there was the money markets, you know, the cost of funding through things like swap rates and stuff like that, was saying, we don't think the Bank of England is going to have to put interest rates up to anywhere near as high as we thought when we were having a little panic last autumn. And then we had the inflation panic over the summer, where a couple of bad inflation readings, one in particular, core inflation reading, made everybody freak out. Inflation's going to stay high. The Bank of England's not going to be able to get it down. And you suddenly saw lenders pull up the drawbridge again, and rates went rocketing back through the roof. Again, there was talk, base rate's going to get to 6.5%. Base rate's going to have to get to 6.5%. Lo and behold, nobody thinks base rate's going to get to 6.5% anymore. We've topped out. We may potentially have peaked well below that, 5.25%. And mortgage rates have started to drift down again. They are still substantially more expensive than they were 2 years ago. You know, when we were talking about a 0.1% base rate, you know, and it means that if you are remortgaging, you're going to end up paying much more. If you are buying a house, you're going to end up paying much more, but you're going to be paying a hell of a lot less if you're fixing for 5 years at 4.29% than anybody who unfortunately maybe had to panic fix at 6.29% over the summer.
You'd be really annoyed though, wouldn't you, Helen? If you see cut after cut after cut and you took one, you know, 10 cuts ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's especially the case for people who've maybe fixed for 5 years. Five-year fixed at the minute are slightly cheaper. So some people have been opting for those, cheaper than 2 years, that is. And yeah, I think someone who fixed a few months ago would be absolutely furious if they've seen some of the cuts that have come through. You know, if you... took a mortgage with Nationwide a few months ago and you see them cut their rates 11 times, yeah, you'd be furious. But that's the nature of the mortgage market now. It's just absolutely mad, and it's really difficult to know in what direction things are going in the sort of long term.
Which means I'm going to ask you anyway, because that's what I do, and obviously don't take advice from a money podcast, but if you are in a position where you're thinking about getting a mortgage, would you wait if you can? I mean, is it going to go down, up?
If you ask us this a lot, and I've been saying for a while,
right.
I've been saying for a while, what I'm hearing is that rates will probably hit around 4% for the cheapest deals, and then brokers are saying that they won't really move down much more from that for quite some time. So might be worth holding off a little bit longer if you can. Obviously, for a lot of people, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a remortgage deadline, they need to move house for whatever reason. I don't think there's too much holding on to be done, although there has been some interesting movements in swap rates this week. So these are the sort of money market rates that show banks where rates might be going in the next few years, and that's how they price their mortgages. So 5-year swap rates this week have dropped below 4% for the first time in months. So that's basically money market saying in 5 years we think that interest rate is going to be about 3.96%. So that's gone below that 4% marker. So that's slightly positive news, but that is obviously in 5 years time, so you can't necessarily trust that too much, but it is an indication.
It's also an interesting time of year, isn't it, Simon? Because you have on your article here, Chris Sykes, mortgage expert, saying that often at this time of year, lenders shut up shop and increase rates slightly. But the opposite is happening this year.
Well, as I mentioned, there's this element of wanting to hit targets. And, you know, to be honest, most banks and building societies financially are doing pretty well. The net interest margin, which is the amount that they make between saving and borrowing, they're doing pretty good. Most of them are making quite a lot of money off the back of that, and it's easier for them to make money when interest rates go up. There have been hints that this might start to tail off, and actually some of the banks, when they released their results, got their share prices dented slightly because they said, well, look, actually net interest margin is probably going to narrow a bit in the future. And actually some of that is because they've been under so much pressure from the Bank of England and the FCA to actually pay people and MPs to pay people better savings rates rather than paying them the piddly savings rates. And the thing is, they've got so many people on legacy savings accounts, and the ones that they get away with paying such small amounts of money on, that if they have to bump those up, it can make quite a big difference. But the fact of the matter remains that across the board, most of them are in a position where they are lending money at higher rates than they are taking money in. And so they want people to borrow it. And actually, you know, they want people to borrow at a slightly higher rate, and they get more interest in than borrow at a lower rate in the future. I mean, it's a good time for them to be trying to make some money. I do think that one of the things people need to consider, though, is the question of this 5-year, 2-year thing, what's going to happen to interest rates, very carefully, but also to think about the flip side of it, of if I go for a short-term fix, and inflation comes back and rates spike again, because we've seen this happen twice in the last year, just over a year. Mm-hmm. We've seen major mortgage panics, that if things don't turn out like everybody expects, am I going to be okay if I have to remortgage in 2 years time? I might be kicking myself because I fixed for 5 years and I end up paying more. But if I'm comfortable with those monthly payments, and I can meet those monthly payments, and that gets me to where I want to be, maybe it is worth me paying for the security of knowing that in 2 years' time, I might not get caught out by a potential round, 476 of the mortgage panic.
Yeah, right. Don't say that, Simon. All right, let's move on then. The price of gold has rocketed to a record high. Now, it's down to a combination of geopolitical turmoil and hopes of interest rate cuts. Gold, often viewed as an insurance policy asset that will perform well in times of market stress, so is now a good time to get involved. And how do you do it? Simon, why is gold soaring?
Gold soaring is quite interesting because gold is moving in the opposite direction to the direction that you would think gold should be moving in. So gold tends to be in particularly high demand at times of higher inflation or when rates are low. So there's a combination of two things there. One is it's seen as an inflation hedge. It holds its value and has held its value. Bitcoin, for example, there's a question about that you've asked me many times before on this podcast. You know, is it the new gold?
To which you guys are making me sound really boring and like I repeat myself all the time. I'm so sorry.
Well, to which my answer
these questions are cyclical.
These questions are cyclical. They come back around. To which my answer is normally, I don't know, ask me in 2,000 years' time and I'll give you the answer. But like, that's the point. Gold's been around for a long time, right? Okay. So people see it as this store of value. It's in demand when inflation is high, but inflation is actually coming down and interest rates have peaked. But interest rates are quite high, and normally you would expect it to be when interest rates are low. So you would imagine that now wouldn't be the best time for the gold price. In fact, the best time for the gold price would have been a year ago. But strangely, it's been moving up. But you've also got to remember that also gold moves on sentiment. It doesn't do anything. This is a famous, Warren Buffett argument against investing in gold. If you take all the gold in the world, which isn't actually very big, and then you bury it in the ground, and you leave it there, you dig it back up, you'll have the same amount of gold. It just doesn't do anything. If you invest in a company goes out, it takes money, it uses it for productive means, it makes profits, it could pay you dividends, it can increase its output, its share price can rise, all that kind of stuff. Whereas with gold, you're just going, well, I think at some point there'll be someone in the future who will pay me at least as much as I've just paid for this piece of gold, and probably more because they'll want it more. So there's that issue. And then secondly, you've got the thing about it being this store of value. And that's another thing that comes into play here, is there is also talk that there might be quite a bit of buying up of gold in places like Asia and Africa, and even like Russia and China, because it's seen as a way to put your money into something and keep your money in something where you're not exposed to the whims of geopolitics. in exactly the same way as if you just have your money in the bank. So, for example, Russians just having their money in the bank have found it considerably harder to move their money around and spend their money since Russia invaded Ukraine. Yeah, there's all kinds of issues like that in play.
Is now a good time to invest, and how do you gain exposure to it if you would like to?
If you want to invest in gold, you've got a couple of choices. You can either buy physical gold, which means that you actually hold that gold yourself, or you can buy physical gold and you get somebody else to hold onto it for you. Because if you are going to buy a large amount of gold, keeping it in your house isn't necessarily a good idea. But there are people who they've got their gold, and the hardcore gold bugs, the kind of prepper end of it, they've got their gold, it's in their house. Or, you know, famously, you read stories about people burying it in their garden and stuff. And it's there for when the bad times come, you know, when society goes to pieces, they've got their gold, they're going to be able to buy stuff. I mean, the only thing I would say is good luck getting a loaf of bread with a bar of gold.
Right, with a bar of gold, exactly.
And in fact, actually, Simon, we ended up with something like the apocalypse a couple of years back, and you could only use your card. No one would even take cash.
Precisely. But how much is a bar of gold? Like, you know, the typical ones you see in the movies. I'm sure that's probably what they're like. How much do you reckon that goes for? Because an ounce is what? About $2,000, $1,500 to $2,000? Is that right? I don't know how much that is. I don't know how much a gold bar would weigh. I'm going to keep talking while you Google, Simon.
So I'm looking at bullion by post, right? Yeah. So you could get a 1 gram gold bar from £59.60. You could get a 5 gram gold bar. That would be very small, from £285.30. A 5 ounce gold bar. 5 ounce gold bar. That would be 8,822. And you could get a kilo gold bar. Right. That's the one you want, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah.
That is the ticket. £52,748.
Right. Yeah, okay. Decent.
And there lies your problem with using that to buy bread come the apocalypse, is, you know,
quite
unless the price of bread goes a chunk off, you're gonna have to be shaving little chunks off. So most people would buy gold and they would hold it with a rep. What you need to do is find a reputable gold dealer. Okay,
right,
so be very careful about this. If you are thinking of investing in gold, come to This Is Money, go to thisismoney.co.uk/investing, read our article on how to invest in gold. Or a lot of people don't choose to hold physical gold, they buy into it through an investment fund, and the popular way to do this is through an ETC, an exchange traded commodity. These are basically like ETFs, which are called exchange traded funds. They are funds that are listed on the stock exchange. They provide investors with exposure to the gold price, and they're backed up. This is the key thing. You want to buy into one that is backed up by physical holdings in bars of gold, okay, that are held in secure vaults. I'd be very careful about thinking that you're investing in gold by doing it in any way that involves CFDs, spread betting, or anything like that. You're exposing yourself to much higher risks. Probably the easiest way for people to invest in gold is to do an ETC, something like the iShares Physical Gold ETC or the Invesco Physical Gold ETC, which get mentioned in our article. They come with very small annual costs. So, for example, that Invesco one, 0.12%, but it's backed by gold bars stored in the London vaults of JP Morgan Chase Bank. And with some of these, you can actually even go see the actual gold holdings just to prove that they are there. It doesn't really prove they're there. It just proves there is some gold there.
Right.
But people like to feel really
selfie. Helen, Bitcoin.
Yeah, so there's been a bit of a Bitcoin rally this week. It soared above $44,000. That's for the first time since April last year. So good day for crypto investors. And that's, you know, that's come back quite strongly. So late last year, it was around $16,000. Sparked speculation among some of the more excitable analysts that Bitcoin could hit $100,000 by the end of next year. But as you said,
would those be the people who've got quite a large holding in it?
So could be $100,000, could be a fiver, you know, we don't know. That's crypto.
Yeah, Simon, it's the sort of antithesis of good investing theory, isn't it? But, you know, people seem to enjoy it. Can you say enjoy it? I don't know. But why is it up?
Why is it up?
Where's it going to go?
Okay, two things that are making people, well, three things. Right. Mm. So first of all, the Bitcoin price has been largely in the doldrums until this year, since the last big spike that saw it reach its peak. And then it tumbled down and then it's just like bobbed around a bit. So that sets it up for a scenario where it can go on a big run. Second thing is that it's got momentum. One of the things about trading or investing is things can get momentum. And once they get momentum, they can just keep going and going and going. As people go, I want to make some money on that too. Oh, I want to make some money on that too. I want to make some money on that too. But you just never know when it's going to turn. That's the very difficult thing. So it's set up nicely with that momentum. Thirdly, there is something called the Bitcoin halving, which is about to happen next year. And that means that miners are rewarded with less Bitcoin. It means there's less Bitcoin around for people to invest in. And it's seen as something that usually acts as a catalyst to get the Bitcoin price to move up. And in anticipation of that, you've got people getting more interested and people buying Bitcoin and people hearing people talking about buying Bitcoin and people hearing people talking about buying Bitcoin and having made some money recently and so on. And it adds to that momentum. The other really important element is that potentially some of the big US financial players like BlackRock are getting quite close to getting it signed off by the SEC that they can offer Bitcoin ETFs. And if they can offer a Bitcoin ETF, it provides an opportunity for people to be able to buy into Bitcoin and institutions actually to be able to buy into Bitcoin in a way that they can't do now. Now you've got to go through a trading platform, for example, eToro, you know, which sponsors this podcast. You could buy Bitcoin through eToro. Now, when you buy Bitcoin through eToro, you're essentially buying it in similar to how when you buy shares in a nominee account, right? But then an eToro will then, they hold that Bitcoin to make up for that. Or you can be buying it through platforms like Coinbase or Binance or things like that. That's the other place people tend to buy it. Or they tend to buy it through some kind of much more esoteric platforms. Or you could try and buy a whole Bitcoin yourself and then put it into a wallet. But these are not the kind of investment opportunities that are open to everybody. There are some people who just won't do this because they see it as outside of the mainstream financial system. It's not regulated. You're not protected in any way. And sometimes people don't want to do that. And institutions can't do that. Institutions find it very, very difficult to invest in Bitcoin at the moment. If an ETF is offered by something like BlackRock, that provides a very, very easy way in. So the expectation is that, say BlackRock offers this ETF, there will be a wave of demand to buy into Bitcoin from people who are interested in taking a small position, but otherwise at the moment can't. And that will lead to more buying of Bitcoin because that ETF is going to have to hold the Bitcoin to make up for all the people investing in Bitcoin through the ETF. So all of these things have come together to send the price up. Now, a lot of these things, people have known about them for quite some time. I mean, this ETF thing's been rumbling on for years. Everybody's known this halving is coming, all that kind of stuff. But as I said, when I was talking about gold, these things are traded on sentiment. And once the sentiment swings in their direction, they can start moving up quite sharply. I mean, the only thing is to remember that, you know, if you've made lots of money on Bitcoin or crypto, that's great. Don't get carried away. You know, make it a very small amount of your overall savings and investments because it is massively volatile and has the ability to seriously dent your wealth. And just because you've got some Bitcoin that you bought when it was at a lower price and it's now worth more does not make you a crypto investing genius. I have some that I bought at a lower price and now it's gone up. I am not a crypto investing genius.
No, Simon. I mean, I don't know. You might be, but is anybody?
No, I'm not. Because I've held it all the way up to the peak and then I held it all the way back down again and I've held it as it went up.
But it's going to go to 100,000, isn't it? Isn't that what Helen was saying?
I haven't got the faintest idea.
Right. I do have one question because we're sort of sticking it in that we're going to talk about oil in a sec. What is it? Is it a commodity or a currency?
Bitcoin.
Yeah. What it actually is it? I mean, it's supposed to be something we can trade, but does anyone actually use it for that reason?
Well, I mean,
you buy anything with it?
I think
legally, I mean,
I think its use as a currency is overrated. I don't think it's actually that convenient to use as a currency, to be perfectly honest. I think it's more down the kind of, you know, commodity way. I mean, the other important thing is that if you do make money on it, you are meant to pay tax on that. right. You are meant to pay capital gains tax on it. There's lots of people who think that they don't have to, but you do. And the taxman will come after you. And the taxman's actually been sniffing around people making profits on Bitcoin for some time now. And I can imagine with people selling up and making more profits at the moment, the taxman will be doing some more sniffing.
I have no doubt. Simon, finally, oil at a low. What's going on there?
Concerns about the global economy.
Right.
Worries about not necessarily global recession, but a slowdown in China. Economy coming off the boil. I mean, if you look at the inflation coming down, for example, inflation is coming down here and in the US, but that's because the economy is, you know, not going as great guns as it was in the US. The economy here hasn't been going great guns for a while, but this in aggregate, that slowdown starts to impact the oil price. OPEC, the oil cartel, also hasn't quite hacked back at production in a way that people expected it would. And then also you've got to remember that, like Bitcoin and like gold, oil is something that is traded and moves and has momentum, and momentum goes up and momentum goes down, and oil has been on the downward trend recently.
Right, so in investing circles theory, plow into oil and don't with Bitcoin and gold because they're high. Is that how it works? You go in when it's low?
Well, I mean, you could do, but I don't know if I'd definitely recommend buying oil directly. Commodity investing is like so high risk.
Can you see it and take a selfie?
Get a barrel. Should have bought some during COVID. They were dead cheap then.
How big is a barrel?
At one point, in theory, people were paying you to take them off their hands.
Yeah.
How big is a barrel?
Yeah, roughly. Is it really big?
Barrel size.
All right,
Get
your arms around it, but like a beer barrel.
You won't get it in your hand luggage.
Okay, just checking. That's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. Imagine diligently saving for a retirement fund. Then you find a great Best Buy 2-year fixed rate ISA to rehouse your money, but then it goes missing. Over £600,000. This is money I've been contacted by 22 such cases so far, which totals £2 million in missing funds from ISAs. Helen, take up the story. Firstly, NatWest. What's this about?
Yeah, so this is a really sad, I think, reader case that's been taken up by our reporter, Helen Curran. Just to be clear, we have a very similar name, but that is not me. I'm not talking about myself in the third person. So she heard from these readers, and they basically, as you said, they'd opened a new 2-year fixed ISA with NatWest. This was back in July that they started. So they were doing the thing that we're always telling people to do, you know, shop around with your savings, find the best rate and switch accounts. So they'd found this NatWest account, which at the time was one of the best buys. So it had a rate of 5.9%, which was, so they were one of the top rates at the time. So they tried to switch, went to NatWest, and for ages, their money just didn't get transferred over. They had £600,000 account that they were trying to transfer. So it was a person who we've called Kevin, it's not his real name, and his wife Sarah, but it was essentially their entire joint retirement savings. And for months, the money just didn't show up in their new NatWest account from their Investec account. Obviously, huge worry for them. I mean, that's your that's your entire retirement fund, and basically kept calling NatWest and saying, where's our huge amount of money? And it just was essentially kind of lost in the ether, which is terrifying that can happen. We've heard actually of 22 other cases where people have said that they've had ISA transfers that have gone wrong, not just with NatWest, I should say, but it does seem like this is becoming an issue for people. And I think it's because, you know, you've had this big savings rate war in recent months. And when banks, especially well-known banks like NatWest, you know, when someone's seen a good rate with a big sort of bank that they trust, people have absolutely piled in. And I think the banks don't necessarily have the resources to handle all of those new applications. They get flooded with them, and then it takes them absolutely ages to do all the admin and actually get the money transferred across.
I mean, they've got it back, right?
They did in the end. So after we got in touch, this was just a few weeks ago, they did finally have the money transferred over. They kind of missed the rate, actually. The rate had kind of gone away by the time this was all sorted out, but NatWest did agree to honour the original rate, which is good. We asked them why this has happened, obviously, and they didn't really give a great explanation, if I'm honest. They said that one in three cases are due to them waiting on the funds from other providers. They didn't really explain what's going on with the other two-thirds of cases, other than saying they needed to reallocate resources to dealing with those cases. But I think it's quite clear that, you know, banks aren't necessarily set up for to do a large amount of transfers in a short amount of time, and especially banks like NatWest, who don't always have the best rates on offer. So although they're used to having a lot of customers, they're probably not so used to having a big rush of applications at one time. But that's probably something that they should have thought about before offering a market leading rate.
It's an absolute nightmare when you think about it. I, you know, all the apps that I've got on my phone that, you know, perhaps investing apps or even pensions, all sorts of things on my phone. And I think it's just numbers, isn't it? Because one little mistake, one computer error, one and it's gone. Like, where's the evidence? Where's the Simon? This is one of the problems of modern day. What do you do?
Well, I mean, it's a major issue, isn't it? Like, that's a lot of money to be without. But any amount of money that you need like that is a lot of money to be without. And if it suddenly just vanishes, and then you think that, okay, that's fine, because I can speak to the bank and the bank will sort it out for me. But, you know, in this instance, the couple have had an absolute nightmare. And I think it's always a concern for people, isn't it, when you transfer money? I mean, at least banks have now introduced that thing where you check the name, where it verifies the name, which is good. But previously, it was like you put in the sort code, you put in the account number, off you send it.
Cross your fingers and,
cross your fingers, And you know, you can double check that, you can triple check that, but it's very easy to mistype something like that. And we've had cases before where people do mistype something like that. It goes into somebody else's account and that person won't give it back. And it becomes quite hard. You're not actually allowed to keep it, just to be clear. If somebody does transfer money into your account by accident, you're not allowed to keep it. But it can be very difficult for the banks to get that money back for people. And we've heard cases before where banks have said, you know, we can't give you all your money back, which is astonishing. But in this instance, you'd like to think that they would have been able to do it quite quickly and sort it out, seeing as they are actually a bank and the money had gone to the bank. But the problem with things like this is it discourages people from switching accounts.
Yeah, exactly.
Moving money, moving ISAs, moving pensions and stuff like that. And so, you know, that's a real issue because it detracts from competition. And anything that detracts from competition means that people are less likely to get good deals and good rates. And the irony here is that actually this NatWest meltdown appears to have been triggered by them offering a very good rate.
Yeah, quite. Well, all right then, let's move on. Finally, reader question time. Tesco savings stamps. Well, it's crane on the case, isn't it? For years, this is not me, but I have been buying Tesco savings stamps and currently have £1,300 worth. It was always the case that you could get cash change when using a card of stamps to purchase an item. So your reader, Helen, was going to make a small purchase, take the rest in cash and use the money for a holiday. Now the scheme is about to end. This reader is informed they can only exchange their stamps for a Tesco voucher. Helen, take up the story. I know nothing about Tesco savings stamps. What's this?
So I think the first thing to address is, what are savings stamps? This is a discussion that we had in the office when I was working on this story. I kind of remember them because I think I remember my great-grandma buying them when I was a kid many years ago. Basically, what they are is it's a savings scheme, largely run by supermarkets, but in the past they were run by lots of different kind of organizations and companies. Essentially, you put money into a physical machine, for example in a Tesco store. In exchange for that, you get a stamp. You stick all your stamps in a book, And mm-hmm. then if you save them until December, usually, you then get some kind of bonus if you save them and spend them in December. So it's kind of designed as a saving scheme, which a lot of people use to pay for their Christmas shopping. So with Tesco, if you got 49 £1 stamps and then you spent them in December, you get a bonus £1 stamp. So it's quite an old fashioned way of saving, but you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Some people really like it because, you know, it's an easy way to save if people pay in cash for their shopping. You know, you have a few pounds left over, you pop it on the machine and you're way out, and it's an easy way to build up savings, you know, without really thinking about it. Also, obviously, if your stamps are stuck in a book, you know, that's much more difficult to spend than just have it in cash or a bank account. So they do work for people, and obviously, you know, you get this Christmas bonus, which is an incentive. So this lady had been saving these stamps for many, many years, and she had £1,300 saved. Tesco have now discontinued the stamps. So as of, I think, the 8th of October, you can't buy new ones, and they only have till the end of this year to spend the ones they've got. If they don't spend them, they have to put them onto essentially a Tesco gift card. So this lady didn't want to do that because she'd been planning to spend her stamps on holiday. The reason she could do that is because since the stamps have been in place, there's been a rule that if you buy something with your stamps in Tesco and you have change, you can get that change in cash. So it's a bit of a loophole. You know, this scheme is designed really for people to spend on stuff in Tesco. But they have this rule that, you know, you could have £100 worth of stamps, you'd go in and buy a stick of gum and you could get £99 in change. That was always the rule. So when she went to try and cash out her stamps, though, she was told that she couldn't, they didn't do that anymore, and that she'd have to put them on a Tesco voucher. Obviously, a Tesco voucher cannot buy you a holiday. So
no.
She was furious and got in touch with me. I called Tesco and said, look, come on, these are about to be scrapped. This isn't going to affect very many people, but, you know, can you just give her her cash, she can have a holiday. They did, which is really good, but they refused to say that anyone else in that situation would be able to do the same. They said they have to call Tesco customer service and they'll kind of do it on a case-by-case basis. So, you know, it's a worry for people who've said, and you know, some people have hundreds of pounds in these stamps, and you know, you would quite rightly be miffed, I think, if they kind of, it's sort of pulling the rug out from under them at the last minute, I think. You know, you can't, what's the point in changing the rules when they're, you know, you already can't buy new ones? It's, I can see, of course, Tesco would much rather all this money be spent in Tesco or on a Tesco voucher, but that wasn't the rules. And I think they, just weren't quite playing fair on this one.
I agree. And that's, you know, she's clearly a loyal customer. Things like this do slightly annoy me when they've got a scheme which is, it's sort of a loyalty scheme, isn't it, Helen? I mean, you could probably call it that. I went to Gales the other day. I had a filled stamp thing and they said no, sorry, we ended that scheme. And I said, but there's nothing on the card that says when you're ending it. Oh, but it was all in our shops. I hadn't seen it, and they were like, no, sorry, we can't. Well, there's your loyalty for you.
Yeah, what were you getting free, Georgie? What were you,
coffee.
What you get free?
Coffee. So they denied you a free cup of coffee?
Yeah, and I'd got all the stamps on the card.
That is immeasurably foolish, isn't it? Because you're going to go around and tell everybody that story.
Yeah.
And mention all the people, and all the, well, they don't, yeah, I mean, they don't know that, unfortunately, you're a broadcaster. But you even if you were just a normal person, right? She's not normal.
I'm a normal person.
She's not normal. She's not
How
normal.
How did you know?
Okay. She's not normal. Even if you were just a normal person, you'd go around and you'd tell loads of people that story. And all of those people would think slightly less highly of Gales after that. They would think, I love its incredibly expensive bread.
It's ridiculous.
But I can't stand what they did to my friend Georgie with that coffee. I'm a little bit less reluctant to spend some money in Gales. And it won't make a huge difference to Gales, but that stuff all adds up. When... what that person could have done is said, I'm really sorry, we don't actually do that anymore, but I tell you what, I'm just going to give you a free coffee.
It's just a cup
of
coffee.
Because one free cup of coffee is peanuts. Why does a plate of spaghetti in a restaurant not just cost me a pound? Well, it's because of all the other costs. You've got to pay to run the restaurant. You've got to pay for the staff. You've got to pay for people to make the spaghetti. Mm. The same with the coffee in Gales. You've got to pay for the rent. You've got to pay for the rates. You've got to pay for the people in the shop. You've got to pay for the lights. You've got to pay for the heating. You've got to pay for the energy. That's why Gales bread has to cost you quite as much as Gales bread does. But the marginal cost of one cup of coffee is teeny tiny. That Gales is already open. They've got a massive amount of sunk costs that have gone into that Gales being open, so you could walk through the door that day happy as Larry and say, I'd like my free cup of coffee please, and then they didn't do it, and you would have told all those people, and they would have all been a bit less happy about Gales, and they got really unlucky, because actually it turned out that Georgie Frost isn't normal. Georgie Frost is also a broadcaster and a podcaster, and now she's told loads and loads of people. And then it sparked a conversation where we talked about it for 4 minutes on one of Britain's most popular financial podcasts.
They do say that all advertising is good advertising, I suppose. Though, I mean, so at least we've spent 4 minutes advertising.
I mean, there's a strong possibility there's people sitting there thinking, oh, God, you know what I fancy? A £4 sourdough.
Right.
Sod the free coffee. I'm going to go get a £4 sourdough.
Helen?
Yeah, I think you should. So the Gales where I live, probably the same with all Gales, has a giant queue outside on a Saturday and Sunday. I think you should just go to one and go down the whole queue and be like, they wouldn't give me my free coffee.
Just before we move off the subject of saving stamps, what's quite funny about this Tesco story is that Tesco actually has a long and illustrious history with saving stamps. Because Sir Jack Cohen, the founder of Tesco, changed the game on Green Shield stamps way back in the 1960s. Green Shield stamps were largely sold through small retailers, kind of corner shops and stuff like that. And basically people would buy the stamps and they'd stick them in their book, and then they would get to a point and then they could then buy things out of the catalogue, out of the Green Shield's stamps catalogue. And it was a way of like putting your money into the pot so that you could then eventually make your purchase. And people like to do this because they see it as a way of saving, because they can't spend that money on something else. They can't be tempted to go, oh, got that fiver there, I'm going to spend it on that instead. They've got £5 of stamps stuck in a book, and you know, it could be quite hard to save those. But Tesco signed itself up to this and suddenly shifted things dramatically. Because obviously they were a big supermarket and not just, you know, this smaller independent stores, played a part in the sort of founding story of Argos, Green Shield stamps as well. But there's a whole other story there. We'll do Green Shield stamps another day.
If you are interested in saving stamps as well, I when I was writing this story, I did a bit of a dig into the history of saving stamps, and I found out that in the 60s, they sold saving stamps to kids in schools, and they had a picture of Prince Charles's baby face on them. So if you would like to see that, then do go and read the article.
Oh.
Amazing. And that's what makes you guys so special. Right, one more item. The real and finally, sadly for us, it is saying goodbye to a dear friend and colleague, Simon. We probably wouldn't be here without Rich Browning. Longtime listeners to the pod, of course, no stranger to him. Talk to me.
Richard was our development editor, which meant that he didn't write much, but he was responsible for all the things that aren't words and pictures on This Is Money. So if you've ever used one of our calculators, checked the savings tables, got a savings alert, looked at a share price, listened to this podcast, watched one of our videos, then you've got Rich to thank. And in fact, you've got him to thank if you've ever read This Is Money at all, because he was a founding member of This Is Money in 1999. So he sadly died suddenly at the weekend. Aged just 57, unfortunately, of heart attack. And Rich was one of those people who never failed to make an impression on others. He had an incredibly dry sense of humour, a great sense of humour, a natural comedian's timing as well. And he loved the absurd. He would say the daftest things. He would manage to make even trivial things, like an email about needing to fix something, immensely funny. In fact, his emails to our tech department are the stuff of legend within the business. And we've had so many people talk to us about him since he died and tell us, you know, what a great guy he was and how special he was to them. And he had that ability to just make everybody's day shine a little bit brighter if they had seen him. So it's terribly sad that he's died. He's left behind his wife, Isabel, and their daughter, Emily, who's in her early 20s. But the other thing about Rich, and I said this in the tribute that I wrote to him for This Is Money, is that Rich is one of the men who built the internet. Now, when we think about the people who created the digital world that we live in, it's the billionaire barons, isn't it? It's the Jeff Bezoses, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Elon Musks, the Larry Brins of this world. But there are other people who did it with a much lower profile and much smaller bank balances, unfortunately, although Rich never stopped trying to increase his bank balance with wild attempts to win the lottery and our incredibly inept lottery syndicate. Another thing where the emails that would go round to it were the stuff of legend. And Rich was there right from the start, because in 1999, working on a brand new financial website was a pretty unusual and pioneering thing to be doing. To put that in context, I think I first used the internet in 1999. I'd finished school, I'd been away and done a snowboard season and gone to Australia, traveling with some friends. And if I wanted to communicate with people back home, I'd go to a phone box, I'd get my parents to ring me back. I don't think it was until I went to university that I actually, you know, first used the internet. And Rich was there working on it. And by the time I started at This Is Money in 2005, he'd already played a major part in turning it into a successful award-winning website. It's got had an array of tools and features, calculators, all things aimed at helping people to understand their finances and engage with them. And laying that groundwork for the success of This Is Money, that means we can do all of the other things that we do. So things like Tanya's exposure with Steve Webb of the underpaid women's state pension scandal, you know, where people are getting billions of pounds paid back to them, women who weren't paid enough pension. All of that is built on the foundation of that hard work that went in the early years, but through all the years, through the 18 years that I worked with Rich, he would be there working tirelessly behind the scenes to try and improve things and make things better. And he was really, really committed to fighting people's corner and just trying to make stuff work better for them and help them to understand things and help them to be able to keep track of their money and engage better with their money, which ultimately leads to people's lives being richer. And like just a few stories about him, you know, so as I said, I first met him just over 18 years ago. I started This Is Money as a reporter, and it's quite daunting walking into your first job on a national newspaper. And he was immediately a friendly face. He was originally from the Northeast, although he lived in Epsom, France, as I used to joke. and he made you feel welcome immediately. He had this wonderful, like, underlying slight kind of Geordie burr to his accent. We bonded over a shared love of music, travel, and the absurd, swapping tales of live gigs, crazy long car journeys. Rich's wife, Isabel, is French. He would always be just nipping over to France. You say to him, "What are you doing this weekend?" He's like, "Oh, I'm going to France for dinner." And he'd be like, "Oh yeah, he's having me on." But it actually would turn out that he genuinely had gone to France for dinner. Whenever he went, they'd love to travel as well, to go on holidays. And he would always go the most crazy roundabout route to get somewhere. So it wouldn't be that he flew direct to somewhere. He'd have flown via some other random city. Again, a lot of this going on with some kind of money saving stuff. And he'd then write about this kind of stuff. And his writing was brilliant. He'd worked as a comedy writer and TV writer in the past. And it would include things like, so for example, he wrote an article about what you need to pack for your holidays earlier this year. This is a line from it. We tend to pack an hour before we have to leave. Some things aren't on there because you know you just won't forget them. Trousers, swimming stuff, Macaulay Culkin. Macaulay Culkin. There you go. You read it. I was sitting reading some of his stuff last night. It was making me laugh a lot. But he also wanted to sort of bring about this togetherness aspect. And that's why he loved this podcast so much. And he was the person who did a lot of the uploading the podcast. He was involved in it at the start. He was involved in the whole concept of the podcast right at the start. And he worked on things like message boards in the early days and stuff like that. Social media, he loved. And those things have had a tendency in the past to show the not considerably favorable traits of some people, but that would just make him try that a little bit harder with them. And I told a couple of stories in the thing I wrote about him. I mean, we made this video once called, it was the bank charges scandal. And this video was to try to explain to people how to get their unfair bank charges back. And the headline concept was that we'd do it as a recipe and it'd be called Cooking with This Is Money. So we found a meeting room and we had a I think we had a mixing bowl, a whisk, a spatula, a wooden spoon, a chef's hat and an apron, and me and Rich and a camera. And it became immediately clear that we hadn't really thought about this much beyond, wouldn't it be funny if we did this and we could get quite a good video? We ended up with about half an hour of footage that we were never able to use of us just falling about laughing doing it. But Rich was always disappointed that we never put that out. We had a conversation about it when we started Lunch Money recently. And he was like, I reckon I could probably still find that and we could put it out. I was like, we are not putting that out. He had this spirit that you need, I think. And that's why I said he's one of the people who built the internet, because it's that madcap genius. It's that willingness to try things, to push people to do stuff. Every day he'd be kind of, he had this wonderful way of like gently questioning what you were doing and like just pushing you to try and do that extra bit, to try that little bit harder, to make that thing that little bit better. And that's the thing that is, you know, the spirit that lies behind those people who have built the kind of modern day digital world that we live in, you know, for better or worse. And he had the spirit of someone who was trying to build it for the better, because there are questions around, you know, how good the internet is for people, but there are people out there working on it who have been beavering away trying to make it, but you know, go all the way back to Tim Berners-Lee kind of thing, that kind of person. He unfortunately had cancer 10 years ago. I have to be careful what I say here, because he hated talk of like beating cancer, fighting cancer, battling cancer. So I'm going to say he stuck two fingers up to cancer. And he saw it off. You know, he loved to travel. This year he'd made it to see his daughter graduate in Holland. He'd been to the Galapagos Islands. And the weekend before he died, he went to Lapland to try and find Santa, is what he said. And had a great time. So anyway, he was very much loved by the This Is Money team, past and present, and we will sorely miss him.
We will. And he, to this day, made the greatest comment about this podcast to me in the quite early days. He said, I wish we had this podcast when I was going through cancer. You've created something really special. He was also the giver of the greatest Christmas gift, which was a can of Brussels sprouts. So canned Brussels sprouts for everyone. On Rich. Thank you so much, Simon. Well done.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful.
Hey, I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce, and special guest development editor Rich Browning from the financial website of the year. And it's a particularly warm welcome to our third annual Christmas taste test. Yes, it is back. Over the next hour, the team will attempt to talk money matters such as shared appreciation mortgages, a holiday Brexit tax, and supermarket price wars as they munch their way through a veritable feast of festive favourites. Gentlemen, a very Merry Christmas to you all. In case you'd forgotten, here's a little reminder of what happened last year.
What we should do is agree here that the only winner tonight was Christmas.
And the loser was definitely Waitrose.
And the loser was definitely Waitrose. The only loser was Waitrose, the only winner was Christmas.
And for you?
I think if I'm going to buy processed food in future, I'd probably go to Lidl.
That's the spirit. That's the spirit, Rich. For everything else of this Christmas day test.
Quarter of the local market is just the best.
Okay, so it's Lidl 2, local market.
Yeah, it's nice.
One, but in terms of this taste test, next year we'll bring in the local market.
It was definitely Lidl. I think Lidl could organise their car parking.
Simon, your food stuff, your festive food stuff that you're most looking forward to trying this morning.
The food stuff I'm most looking forward to trying this morning is the turkey, because as is traditional in this test, it's not real turkey, is it? It's not real turkey, is it? It's turkey ham, isn't it? Joking aside, I think that I'll go with the Stilton. I think I'd like the Stilton the most, and I think you know exactly what I'd like the least.
Sprouts? See, Rich, for you, I'm sorry, I lied. I couldn't make it down to the local market. We did have a wild card offering, which I'm very excited to reveal to you a little bit later what that might be. But for you, what are you most looking forward to and least looking forward to?
Well, if we're not going to be joking about this, I think I'm going to go for most looking forward to the cranberry sauce.
Okay, good one, yeah.
I didn't know there were different types.
Yeah. So, it depends where you go. I can't account for the ingredients of them, but apparently so.
So, wow, yeah, bring it on.
But there is all joking. This is what it's all about,
right.
Rich.
Well, so, I discovered this year the only reason I think people don't like Brussels sprouts is because when they were little boys, they tried to fill their nostrils with them.
I was about to educate you there. I don't think I threw this together. I mean, there was a lot of research that went into this show, Rich. Actually, it's a genetic thing, by the way. Yeah. The reason you don't like sprouts is passed through your genes for the bitterness taste. So there you go.
A serious level.
This will set the tone for the rest of the hour.
I like A, the best. I suspect it might be the cheapest. It's quite sort of cheaply creamy.
I can say is I've no idea. Lee, to you, ever said your thoughts?
Yeah, it's definitely B. That is a proper Stilton. Yeah. It's got a lovely strong note on the palate. It's really nice. Washed down with some port by a fireplace. That would be lovely.
You speak to people every day. You hear from them every day. They're on the website. What are they telling you?
There's half of them are very, very angry about something that nobody quite understands. I think, you know, over the next year, this kind of economic uncertainty is going to affect everybody, and I don't think we can expect a change in the base rate in this country for another year or so. I think George is going to win Eurovision. You heard that here first. But I don't think there's any good news for savers in the coming months, I'm sorry to say.
I don't know where to go with that. Rich, for you, your favourite and your least?
Oh, gosh, have you heard of this thing called prison wine that the prisoners make in the cisterns in the toilet? I think...
No.
I think C tasted a bit like that.
Wow, OK. I'm assuming that's your least favourite then, yeah?
D has been dead for far too long. A, though, the one that Lily disliked the most, is extraordinary. It's just this, it's squidgy and...
For the joys of radio, that's not working. I'm just going to go for A and D for you because Tom's going to do the proper scoring. I'm just giggling at what you say. Any of the sprouts? You like the sort of grey-looking ones,
don't you? I hope they're the tinned ones. They taste of bread. They're amazing.
I mean, Georgie, I need to teach you how to cook some sprouts, man. I mean, you need to take off the outer shell because
right.
That's the bitter part.
All right, enough of that.
And then they need to be boiled for about 6 to 8 minutes.
Yeah. There we go. And do you know what? It's perfect time now for our final course, just to get my own back on you, Lee. Yes. I know you're looking forward to this because you're a big mince pie fan.
I just want everybody listening out there to understand that we are doing this properly, stuffing our faces with them. Mince pies.
You are. I'm taking photographic evidence of it. But I want to ask, while we end our festive taste test, and Lee is looking a bit bleary-eyed there, so stay with us, Lee. Stay with us. But I'm so sorry, Lee. I was slightly distracted there. Simon's just wrapped up. What is that? Mince pies with Brussels sprouts. Look, Simon, we'll give you a doggy bag if you want to take them home. Don't worry about it. We've got tons out there. It's okay. But now the results are ready. We are ready to give you the score. And it's the moment that really no one's been waiting for, but it'd be rude not to, quite simply. The winner and loser of our festive taste test, overall on price, from Waitrose, Tesco, Lidl, and the wild card pick.
And coming bottom of the list is the wild card, our local corner shop. And for the mince pies, the local shop clawed it back a bit here. The wild card was the clear favourite for the mince pies, and bottom of the list was Tesco.
Well, you've totally revealed it in an unspectacular fashion that the wild card was indeed the corner shop at Pimlico, because let's be honest, we've always forgotten something, haven't we? So, and I also should point out, by the way, that those I want to say olive colour, but I think it's more brown. Brussels sprouts were a gift to me in June. Were they not, Rich Browning? From your good self, as my Christmas present.
It all makes sense now.
It was a Christmas present for either last Christmas or this one.
Oh,
but the great thing about those is they last until...
No, they don't.
Not next year, but the Christmas after that.
Is the decomposing in that pot.
Giving. Thank you very much to editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce, and our special guest, Rich Browning, for you and your sprouts. A very Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.